opportunity to go and sort of be a liaison and help them build the merchandising part of the business in San Francisco. And I did that for probably about a year, year and a half, and we raised a total of about $18 million for that company. And then, of course, you know, had a planned IPO and everything else, but then things didn't work out.
Let me just backtrack a bit, if I can. You started off in the middle of a bunch of high-level stuff. I mean, how did you come from nowhere? Like, where did you come from? Like, how old are you, and where did you grow up, and how did you get into this kind of level? I mean, that's just impressive.
And so I'm 34. I moved out straight out from college. When I want the exact details, I followed a girl who I met in college. I went to school at Boston College.
Was she cute?
And she's very cute. Not with her anymore. Married now. No, she's she followed her up here and ended up, my father was actually in an elevator. And he was in the Bahamas. He was in an elevator with a gentleman who he had met and was involved in some other business-related things. Have a family business up in Canada that's a 100-year-old business, and they have a technology fund that they invest in certain companies and certain things. And so it was made known.
What kind of business is your 100-year-old business?
There's a bunch of different companies in the portfolio. It's oil and gas, so real estate, broadcasting, manufacturing, insurance.
A bit
that's about it. Yeah. So anyway, and that's that company that's based in Canada, and you know, run by my father and my sister, and they're all involved in that. So anyway, there's a part of their sort of fund that they invest in some technology related things, and this shopping.com concept was pitched to him by a gentleman by the name of Bob McNulty, who had a good long, I would say good long, but definitely challenged history in retail. He'd been very successfully sold the company to Home Depot and Home Base or wherever, and he'd been very successful. Anyway, he had this concept for shopping.com, and we got in there, and that's how I was introduced to the company, basically. I went in there as a you know, 34th person employee, a management team. It was deemed at that point in time that, you know, kids 30 and younger were smarter for whatever reason than people who were 40 and older. So bringing as many of those people because they know how to use computers and see what they can do. So really, I was just a young buck out of college. I didn't know anything. I learned everything that I know in that first business with respect to, you know, the early e-commerce stuff. And frankly, as far as I'm concerned, you know, I think we were probably lucky. The company was, you know, we raised, over $12 million in the course of, you know, that year and a half period, but it was really one of those situations where, you know, we could have just as easily, we weren't profitable, we could have just as easily gone out of business if we hadn't generated the interest from an M&A standpoint with the guy at Compaq. So,
you guys made out well in the end. Are you in shopping.com is still a force today?
Yes, so shopping.com has had two lives. It died once. It went into AltaVista. It died, and AltaVista got sold to CMGI. CMGI ended up with the domain, and then CMGI died, and the domain got purchased by DealTime. And DealTime changed their name to shopping.com and then resold again as a shopping comparison network, right, to eBay. So really there's been two different businesses with that URL.
Okay, so the name was what was valuable. Did you guys make it valuable?
The first transaction was $220 million, and then the second transaction was, so yeah, I did okay, and the second transaction was $500 million, and that was, you know, I wasn't involved in that. So.
Congratulations, you did well.
I think lucky.
That's
I think lucky for the first one. Anyway, so after that, I went up to San Francisco, lit up there. I didn't like weather up there too much. I was commuting back and forth to Newport Beach, which is where I was living at the time, and ended up, you know, running into Rich Rosenblatt and meeting him. I made an investment in a company called DrGoop.com. At the time, Richard had just sold iMall to Excited Home for, I think, north of $500 million. But he was quite successful. He was only 27, 28 years old. And partnered up with him, he was starting a venture capital fund called Prime Ventures. And Prime Ventures was a $20 million fund. I came in and basically joined as a partner in sourcing deals. I think we're kind of slow at that point. It was 2001, 2002. Wasn't much capital out there. Weren't too many things happening. And so we ended up creating a few good properties, one of which was a joint effort with the founder of Reunion.com, which is Jeff Tinsley. We didn't actually perform the investment out of the fund, but we're all investors in Reunion.com. Reunion.com now is a very, very, you know, quite a big, successful company. They're doing more registrations per month than Facebook is, which is surprising.
Do they pay for free registrations?
Those are free registrations, but they have a membership. They have a paid membership that they upsell a certain percentage of their audience.
And are those driven virally or through media buying?
It's all media buying. Yeah, they do a lot of advertising. You've probably seen Reunion.com all over the
place. I don't think it's possible to do that without thing, is it?
Yeah. So... yeah, you should interview Jeff, by the way. He's a great guy, one of my best buddies. So anyway, there's a syndicate of kind of internet guys that are floating around here, and we actually ended up starting a business, investing in business concept and starting it, which is kind of what Richard's MO was to take a business that had either been sort of fledgling along but had good potential and infuse our management and some cash and see if we can get something started. And we ran across a company called SuperDudes. SuperDudes was a kids gaming network where you could create, you know, children, you know, kids, sort of mostly boys, 14 and under, create avatars. And use these avatars to play Shockwave type games online, and create your own superhero character. Okay, so, and then we ended up actually, Richard got called to, in late 2003, early 2004, we knew Brett Brewer, who was the president over at Intermix Media, which at the time was the Universe Media, or Universe, he called Richard and said, hey.
I've got a big question since you know those guys, so who is the one true founder of MySpace?
Funny. The one true founder of MySpace is actually two. I would call it two. It's Tom and Chris.
Really? There's no, I wouldn't say it's,
it's not Greenspan. It's no, it's not Brad Greenspan. It's not Brett Brewer. It's not Rich Rosenblatt. It's not, you know, it's nobody but those two guys. They created the concept. And actually, well, we can go into a whole other conversation on that. Like, they're good buddies of mine, too. And actually, Chris and Josh are really good buddies of mine. I knew them from before they were involved in MySpace.
Joe Abrams?
No, not that well.
He's interviewed him. We're going to be running his interview fairly shortly. He's okay. One of the investors as well.
Great.
Anyway.
Well, anyway, so what happened was Rich went over there to run Intermix, and that was on Brad's, you know, Brad was departing from Intermix at that time, and Rich went through the interview process, and what happened was I ended up sort of, you know, holding on to some of the other properties that were in sort of the Prime portfolio, but then also some other companies that we had started just before Richard's departure to go and run Intermix Media, and we ended up actually selling Superdudes. I was the chairman of Superdudes, and we ended up selling that to Intermix. So we ended up owning some stock in Intermix, and that was kind of an exciting thing. We didn't know at the time that it was going to be as exciting as it ended up being.
So you made money on MySpace,
though. Yeah. Yep. So, yeah, so it was pretty interesting. We did well on that one, and then since then we've had an opportunity to invest in 10 or 15 more different companies. I sit on the board of three or four of them. I didn't tell you about one company I started, which is still around. We haven't sold it or done anything yet, but we raised about $13 million from Clearstone and Vendors and WTI. It's a company called eForce Media. I was the founder of this company. It's a customer acquisition marketing company, as I like to call it. Some people call it lead gen. We operate in we're similar to Oakland Street. We operate in about.
Let me ask you two quick questions on that.
Sure.
You've done well with some of your investments, so it would seem like you've got some capital behind you.
Uh-huh.
Why would you raise money to start some of these companies rather than just doing it yourself? And then secondly, why would you raise money to start a lead generation company when that's generally you can do it without raising money?
Yeah, so most companies that I've ever been involved in from a founding standpoint, I always put my own cash in first. So I'm always the first 500 or grand or $1 million in.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But the company requires more than that. I mean, I think it's I wouldn't advise any founder of any company to not have want to bring in partners, financial partners to support the business along, you know, along the way in its growth. I can address the lead generation eForce business. The reason we raised as much capital as we did is because we took a very different undertaking. We built a lead aggregation system that can take, you know, the way I see the lead gen business is very different than a lot of people. I think that there's a huge overflow in consumer requests versus the ability for those companies to appropriately service those consumer requests to individual people. Most lead gen companies won't tell you this, but they drop 40% of their leads on the floor, and that's because they're not matching them appropriately with the auto dealer or the debt company, or it's not, for whatever reason, they don't have the nationwide coverage for those particular, you know, leads that are being generated. When you cast a wide net on the internet, advertising-wise, you're going to bring in, you know, leads or consumer requests for services from anywhere, right? You can only target so much, and so how do you appropriately make money. If you're spending money, you know, on advertising, you're only bringing in what you need, some sort of a targeted thing. Well, you just raise the price on your lead, so you can be profitable on the leads you do sell. If the ones you don't sell, it doesn't matter because you're profitable on the ones you do sell. So what we did is we built a system that would basically take overflow inventory from other companies, people that would be competitors to, you know, eForce and any other light, and be able to take their, you know, their overflow leads and sell them through, similar to that of a lead point. And so that's why we built a lot of technology in the early years and raised the necessary capital we needed to do that.
I mean, I talked with a couple of the lead gen companies. I published an interview with Brad Powers and another one with Matt Wise.
Yep.
They've not mentioned anything like this overflow. I mean, how well has that actually worked for that company?
Yeah, I think it's because people just don't really, you know, there's lead monetization, there's lead yield monetization, there's traffic monetization. So a lot of people spend a lot of time driving traffic to a web page and focusing on the conversion of that raw traffic, right, that media spend to the consumer request. Very few people spend a lot of time focusing on actually how that consumer request is sold, how it's monetized on the back end. It's mostly done on a traffic basis. It's not done once the lead data has been created. We have a series of algorithms that actually allow us to multi-sell the lead when it's appropriate, right? And then also be able to directly, you know, sell them into other networks that have coverage in the specific area. So if somebody's buying a yellow Mustang on a Tuesday in Arkansas, we'll know where that dealer is. AutoByTel might not even know where that dealer is, right? But PriceWheel probably does. And so the fact of the matter is we can be kind of like almost like Switzerland from a lead standpoint, because you know AutoByTel is going to trade leads with PriceWheel, right? We can go to all the aggregators and actually service all the aggregators. They're going to dump all their overflow inventory into us. We do have 100 sites. We do generate our own leads in all of these industries. Auto is our biggest business currently. There's some good opportunities there. I think that the technology that we built is definitely something that needs to be sold into the market a little bit more. LeadPoint has done a pretty good job of marketing themselves to the smaller publisher or to the smaller, lead generator. I think that we're probably more a group that needs to focus, and we're still in the building process, so we need to focus a little bit more on positioning the business to work with other larger companies. You know, Clint Street could revive
those guys, let me know.
Yeah, I know a lot of Amtrak. I know all the guys in the business and stuff, although I hadn't been involved. So I was the CEO of the business for the first couple of years. And then I handed the reins over to a guy by the name of Andy Mazzarella. And Andy was Richard's partner at IMAL. And so he was quite successful in that deal. And he wanted to come in, and we sort of cut a deal to have him come in and act as CEO, and I moved up to chairman. And it was really because I'd fallen in love with this concept of after MySpace had sold, and I was looking at the growth of these things, and Facebook was sort of bubbling up, and I thought, gosh, you know, this whole e-commerce industry is really going to blow up in a peer-to-peer manner in some capacity. And who's going to be there? Who's going to be sophisticated enough to offer people, you know, the tools to be able to transact online? Leveraging these social networks, and that's what I really, really fell in love with very quickly. And so it was good that Andy came in to run the company, and he's been sort of instrumental in continuing to grow the company. E-Force just recently purchased a company called Alena. Alena was a former Intermix company, a product marketing company. I don't know if you've ever heard of Hydroderm, market product.
Yeah, so they bought the asset that left over when the MySpace sale happened.
That's correct. Yep.
Mm. But it's not around anymore. Is it still around?
Sure, yeah. It's a $40, $50 million a year business.
Okay.
Yeah.
And that's actually a part of E-Force.
Yeah. Oh,
okay.
So anyway,
on the LinkedIn stuff, I mean, it's such a competitive space. I mean, a lot of those guys are getting absolutely crushed as margins are shrinking and all that kind of stuff. It would seem to me that if there is a lot of space, a lot of wastage with leads on and getting to the floor, that those guys would be working on that. Or is this a big opportunity they're all missing?
Well, it took a lot of sophisticated technology building, and then a lot of network building. So we had to actually build a client base that is by and large pretty big. Now, when you're in one particular vertical, and people categorize lead gen as, you know, here's what's happening with the industry, but the reality is just a huge number of people were involved in financial services and subprime, you know, mortgage, and those are the people that got seriously crushed. The people in auto aren't doing that bad. The people in debt are doing great. Cash advance is taking a little bit of a dip, and, you know, education seems to be kind of relatively consistent. So I think that there's, and it's really just a function of what vertical or what industry you're in, how much you applied to that vertical or industry. I think it's an addictive business. So you get into a situation where you pick up a big, you know, mortgage client and they give you $1 million a month, and hey, where else are you going to focus your energy when you've got one guy who's offering you $1 million every month? I mean, it's that kind of a business is, you know, these guys all start out small, right? They don't raise a ton of capital. They start out with two or three guys running some websites, driving some traffic, generating some leads. So they don't have the opportunity to look sort of beyond that $1 million paycheck every month, and frankly, why would you? So the industry is comprised of, you know, 70-80% of the industry is comprised of these companies. I mean, the guys that are making $10 million a year, and they're sitting at home in their underwear and just cranking out, you know, marketing that drives traffic to a couple pages and title leads.
Right.
That's not a sophisticated way to run a lead gen business, you know.
So you want to take a step back, because that ties in my other question of raising capital again. So you'd rather be able to take a longer view, do it with raising capital, and hopefully take a big shot at it.
Definitely.
Because the other point of that is that various people I've been speaking with are suggesting that the venture capital model is running into trouble. I mean, I saw in the Wall Street Journal yesterday this article about Sequoia and how they're starting to look into doing stuff like managing endowment type funds and things like that. Do you see a long-term model of venture capital?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. There's no question. You know, not only is venture capital getting hurt by, you know, by the way they operate, but they're becoming less interesting from an entrepreneur standpoint. And that in and of itself is a whole other conversation I could tell you about, something that I'm getting involved in, which is more public venture capital, which is really a really interesting business, that I really have sort of fallen for, simply because I've done a venture capital route, and it can be challenging. It can be challenging. Down the road, it can be challenging. I think you end up with partners that want to, I think they're smart people and they want to help you with your business, but they definitely don't share the same experience and interest level from a certain perspective. And some of them, frankly, would rather you continue to grow and rather give you money, because every time they give you money, they take a little bit more of your company, and then hopefully get to some bigger Google-type goal, right? Because that's what their MO is for the portfolio, not so much, you know, what the specific interest for your company is, right? I think that's where the disconnect is.
Because most of the interviews I've been doing, people that have taken money regret it, and the guys that didn't take money, happy they didn't. For you, for a minute, tough venture capital thumbs up or something?
You know what? In the interest of protecting my friendships with the guys that, that I'm involved with on the venture capital side, I'd say I'll tell you what, my advice here is how to structure this. My advice to an entrepreneur is, analyze it closely. Don't just chase, you know, don't just find the first paycheck that's sort of, you know, flashed in front of your face, because there's probably a good opportunity for capital outside of, you know, a venture capital for a small entrepreneur might be a really comfortable type environment to initially move into, because you've got a lot of support and people on your board and people that, you know, have good advice and everything else. But the reality is, once you grow in the business, they're not as appealing to have there. Especially if you're trying to maneuver from a valuation standpoint and raising additional capital, it's very challenging. Even major business decisions, strategic moves, partnerships, M&A type activity, all become much more challenging because you signed up for preferences, liquidation preferences with these guys that, you know, prevent you from doing certain things down the road.
One on the capital topic, if I may ask you.
Sure.
What is your opinion on reverse mergers for a net company today?
Well, I'll tell you what. I think it's a very tough spot for some people. I think it's a very smart thing for others. And I know that's a bad answer to a good question. But the best way to describe, you look at Intermixed Media. Intermixed Media was good, bad, I don't know. It spawned MySpace, and it was the product of a motorcycle, you know, company reverse merger. I think here's my perspective on it. It's similar to financing. People look at it like, while you're going through the process and you're dealing with, you know, getting into public market, if you don't have the ability to navigate through the early stages of the public market, it can be a challenging thing. But frankly, once the company's public, there's a whole new world of an investor base out there that's willing to, you know, fund the company. And actually, in today's market, there's a ton of that type of capital, small cap capital out there available for those types of companies. I think people don't really care once you are public. I think the word reverse merger is like lead gen. It's gotten a bad name. But stacks are...
If you're an OTC stock or, you know, the pink sheets, that kind of stuff, it doesn't look good. But my understanding is that it's actually becoming something that is a smart way to cash out and to be able to do M&A type stuff.
It is, and there's a ton of capital there. You know, these guys, these small investment banks, and there's a billion of them, that have a ton of capital to exercise towards businesses like this, if treated properly. And it is more of an exercise in patience and in strategy than normal taking a venture capital, signing a check, and signing some paperwork. There's a lot more to the process associated with, you know, running a small cap company. But I think that there's a lot of benefit to it, there's no question. I think, you know, I'll share this with you, but that's why I'm looking at, you know, being involved in what I consider a public venture capital business. That will enable small companies to, you know, that are profitable, obviously, to raise the $10 million they want to raise and take the company public in the public market. And that'll be done by a number of different ways. It could be a reverse merger, could be a, you know, just an SB2 filing, it could be a number of different things. But there's definitely companies that are popping up to compete aggressively with venture capital in this for small business and in the internet.
Right. Cool.
These bankers, you know, they don't have access to the MySpaces or Facebook. I mean, in the public market, these guys, none of these companies, none of these companies ever get into the public market. They're all sold before. So
right.
taking some of these exciting businesses and putting them in the public market can be a beneficial thing.
Joe Abrams told me they can get 3 to 4 times the valuation if they're public. I mean, it's a much more public thing, and so that can make a dramatic difference to the stockholders.
Yep.
Okay. So, why don't you tell us about Chop It?
Okay. So basically, you know, like I mentioned, I stepped out of the day-to-day role at eForce to construct a plan. Really, this is something I thought eBay should be doing.
Have
ADD? Do I have
ADD? You couldn't resist starting another company, right?
I totally have ADD. I feel like this conversation, I really actually am enjoying the conversation because it's very ADD-oriented.
Right. Oh, see, yeah, point at closing glass house, shouldn't start stones. Is that what you mean?
That's right. Yeah, you got me. I've got a little bit of that going on. So I really fell in love with, I saw what, you know, here was this big box retail concept, eToys, Amazon, you know, buy.com, shopping.com, popping up in sort of late 90s, early 2000s. And then there was this next wave in e-commerce of all these shopping comparison engines, right? PriceGrabber and ShopZilla and all these guys popping up, shopping.com number two. And they all sold for $500 million and they're all wildly successful and still growing. And I thought to myself, gosh, the next evolution in commerce, in e-commerce, in this business is going to be something that I believe they should be doing, which is a hyper-distributed commerce platform, hyper-distributed commerce world that brings social networking communities, simply because they're the fastest growing community, but it could be anywhere on the internet, it could be Blogger, it could be anything, together from a commerce perspective. And applying the intelligence that brings people together on LinkedIn and on Facebook, and applying that same type of intelligence to put buyers and sellers together in a world that operates similar from a transaction standpoint to the way eBay operates, right? You make offers, you make, you know.
It's blindly obvious now that you explain it to me. Why haven't they done that?
Well, good question. I'll give you the answer. Okay, here's the short answer. The short answer why eBay haven't done it is one, social networkers don't like to pay for things. Okay, So they want free stuff. There's, you know, 100 million 17-year-olds that are turning 18 next year, all going to be legal transactional credit card holding people. But guess what? None of them want to pull out their credit card and pay listing fees or hosting fees or transaction fees. eBay is a public company. They're focused on EBITDA. They're focused on things that prevent them to quickly maneuver into the social networking world. And so they're going to have a very difficult time doing it. But, hey, they bought Craigslist for the exact same reason. They couldn't just go out and build a free, you know, classified listing service. So I don't know what that tells you about.
They got that investment in it, yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, that's the whole reason. And so I think that there's certain businesses that they can, you know, they're going to have a tough time moving into on their own, but that's why they make acquisitions.
So you're venturing into the territory of non-buyers, and you're going to send them into buyers, or as they are older, they'll become buyers. How does that actually work? Because they're hardest
people. I actually think of the contrary. I think they're all buyers. I think they're all buyers and sellers. People, if given the opportunity to transact in a simple way on the internet, will do so. I have a pair of vintage jeans, and you may have a basketball or a pair of hockey skates that you wouldn't have otherwise taken the time to go through the 40-page process of registering with eBay and paying listing and transaction fees. But if given the opportunity to just simply upload it onto your Facebook page and blast it up to your network and advertise in a simple way, you might do that. I think there's 100 million people out there that are buyers and sellers that aren't even using eBay and don't have a means by which to do it. E-commerce right now for an individual person is time-consuming, costly, and complicated. All we're doing is removing all of those contingencies. We're saying, here's commerce, it's free, go.
So let's say I've got a basketball I want to sell. I upload a photo of it to my Facebook page. Does that mean that only my friends see it, or how does that get published, and how do people search for it?
So there are two ways. One of them is immediately, the way our system works is we're going to immediately, so if you upload your basketball, we're going to show you, hey, there's 27 people, let's say you're in the Dominican Republic, maybe a bad example, but say you're in Santa Monica, California. We're going to show you the 25 people in Santa Monica, California that are interested in buying your basketball immediately. And they're on Facebook. And we're also going to show you the 38 people that are on MySpace that live in Santa Monica that are interested in buying basketball. And the only reason we know all this stuff is because we're extracting all this information from, you know, one, all the people who have already installed the application on their Facebook or MySpace or Bebo page, but also, two, other publisher networks within those social networks.
But, I mean, how do you know that someone wants to buy? How are they showing intent to buy a basketball in Santa Monica?
Okay, so we know where the people live, right? That's pretty obvious. We know where, because, you know, the open APIs from the social networks feed you information about the profile, right? Mm-hmm. So we can say, here's Joe Blow, he lives in Santa Monica, he's 27 years old, he plays for the basketball club of Santa Monica, and he wears Nike shoes, and he drinks Slurpees on Thursdays, and he drinks beer on Friday. I mean, we can gather all that information through other applications and other APIs, right? So we know stuff about a person that can become commerce-related information. What we can't specifically tell you yet, and we will eventually, is whether this person searched for a basketball before. So if this person was searching for basketball somewhere, we would have that information, be able to say, hey, here are all the people that have previously searched for basketballs. And so these are the people you should target. And similar to the way Reunion operates in connecting people after they pay, we're going to allow people to buy small incremental units of advertising to connect to these buyers through other networks. The most important thing to remember about Shopit is that it's a community-agnostic platform. It operates and connects buyers and sellers from Facebook to MySpace to Bebo to HiFi to Zanga, and then obviously a huge blogger world as well. It synchronizes your profile anywhere you are. So if you're selling something on Bebo, on your store on Bebo, you can launch the application on Facebook and all your products will show up there.
Because the thing with eBay is that, and the same with Google, is they both have buyers searching and demonstrating intent. Whereas I guess you're not going to have that. So that linking of product to buyers is going to be, I guess, a difficult part. Is it not, or am I not understanding something?
Yes and no. And let me just describe it. So basically, eBay operates in a walled garden environment, right? So you come to eBay, and because they've got 66 million users in their buyers and sellers, you can actually pretty quickly list something and find there's, because of their critical mass, you'll find that there's stuff there. When eBay first started, I don't know if you've ever seen some of the documentaries on the initial, you know, launch of eBay, but the reality was they were actually going out and putting in, you know, stink bids on certain items internally from the company outward, just to try to make people feel like there were people bidding on their item. The reality is, oh, yeah, absolutely, because they needed that critical mass. It was just good fortune that they had, you know, they grew quickly and had critical mass so people could actually buy and sell things and feel like that they were the stuff. So they created what we call a marketplace. We don't, at Shopit, don't have a marketplace, but we don't need a critical mass in order to do that. There could be 150,000 people in our network, and we'll still bring buyers and sellers together in a better way than eBay would. And we'll do that based on information that we have coming from these social networks. And so it's really just applying the connecting of a buyer and seller based on specific data about the seller's item.
Each other, but I want to sell that basketball in Santa Monica. It would look at your profile and say, well, you've registered on MySpace. You've got to put the keyword basketball on your profile. Therefore, when I'm trying to sell it, it'll send some message to you to let you know that I have a basketball for sale.
Absolutely. It'll advertise right either on through one of my applications or send a message. And I can have it sent to my mobile phone, or I can have it sent to, you know, anywhere. So it's a very, very targeted, specific ad network for e-commerce is basically kind of a way to describe it.
How it not in that kind of instance, how it not turn into spam? I mean, you might mention a basketball in there. There might be 3,000 guys trying to sell basketball stuff in Santa Monica.
Sure.
And you'd want to take the keyword off your profile.
You can actually turn it on and off. So there's a function where you can turn all any messaging on and off. So if we're sending it to you via email, we're going to send you a message saying, hey, we noticed you're excited about basketballs. Would you like to hear about, you know, people selling basketballs? And then if you say, yes, great. If not, no. You know, it's just targeted advertising. There's no secret recipe there.
And so you're interested in scanning everybody, or you're getting out of the APIs that they have, so you're getting
that. That's right. So they can shut off at a Facebook level. They can say, no, I don't want to show anybody and make my profile private, blah, 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 you know, those types of things. Or they can shut off specific things. Yeah, I'm involved in horse riding, but I don't really want to tell people or show people about that. And we would message them saying, hey, there's a horse riding club in Santa Monica. There's 45 people that are, you know, buying and selling really connected to these people. And then if you want to, you get connected to them.
How many users have you got using it? Ta-da.
So right now, there's 160,000 stores. Most of them are on Facebook, but we're seeing MySpace is starting to grow pretty quickly. We hope to have 1 million by the end of the year.
How many users do you have?
That's how many users we have.
Oh, to be a store, you have to be a user as well?
Yeah, to be a user, you have to have a store and vice versa. But what they are store application installs. So when you install the application, the Shopit application on your MySpace, your Facebook, or your Evo page.
Hey, have you found building Facebook applications like that? Is it working well?
We love it. I mean, we're the fastest growing e-commerce application on Facebook. We're about 15 times the size of eBay on Facebook. We're definitely the fastest growing e-commerce business of social networking that we know of. Most of the guys are doing, the biggest guys are doing like 100 signups a day. We do an average between 4,000 to 5,000 a day.
Oh, really? And that's just virally driven from friends seeing it.
Virally driven, yeah. I mean, yeah. Matt loaded the Shopit store. Now Jimmy loads the Shopit store. He's selling this. And people are selling stuff. You know, we're noticing that 88% of the people that are installing the store application, it's not just like poking or firing or something like this, all these other dumb, jokey ones. Mm-hmm. It's like a real deal. People are treating it like a real business. They're uploading product. 88% of people within a 2 to 3 day period are actually uploading real products that they want to sell. Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about the actual numbers of transactions that are being done on it?
I think transaction volume, because we're not making money on transactions, we don't charge transaction fees, so it's not as relevant for us. But transaction volume is probably to the number of, we want to try and maintain anywhere between 10 and 50%, you know, obviously as we grow up within a certain time period, and we're growing towards that number. It's hard to track in early stages, simply because we're right now it's a little bit more of a land grab game, and we want to end up with, you know, 5, 10 million people in the commerce network, and we're pretty confident we can do that pretty quickly.
And so how do you make money from it?
So we have it's an advertising network, right? So similar to the way you would buy a Google keyword as a small advertiser to promote your website in a search engine, you're going to promote your basketball by buying small amounts of advertising, $1, $2, $3. We're going to show you people you can advertise directly to, and then we're going to say, hey, come in and buy these small advertising units, create your ad, and I'll email you a picture of what it looks like. It's basically a console where you can go in through your profile on Facebook or on MySpace, and you can create your ad, upload your picture.
So you get free promotions of what you're selling to your friends that are linked into your profile, and then if you want to get wider access than that to other people, then that's where you can buy some small amounts of advertising.
Absolutely correct. So, like, a big percentage of our audience right now is growing is eBay. We get a lot of eBay power sellers coming in, uploading thousands of products. We put a button on our homepage basically says, here, import all of your, you know, eBay catalog in one click. So these guys are just, like, pouring in because they don't have to pay fees. It costs them nothing to do that. The first thing they want to do with their spendable money is, where do I buy advertising? How do I promote my stuff? I don't have a big network on MySpace, but I want to reach the 150 million people on MySpace. How do I do that? Well, we can do that for them, right? We can take those products you're selling now on eBay, syndicate them out throughout the publisher network. We're going to charge you 15-cent CPC for this advertising, and we're going to go out and pay the publisher, you know, 5-cent CPC. So there's a big opportunity there. We want 6 million people spending $1 a week on advertising, and we're going to make it real easy for them. We're going to give them that advertising for free, paid for by partners. We have lead generation opportunities. We have partnerships with companies like Revolution Money, who are going to load their account with $25. So if you sign up with Revolution Money through Shopit, you're going to have a free account with like a PayPal type account with $25 preloaded in it. And guess what? Those are $25 in advertising credit that you can use to buy advertising to target all of these people. So it's free to the user even then.
You know, I have to say that when you first started telling me about this, I thought you were crazy.
Yeah.
It's making sense now.
Okay, good.
Really interesting. Really interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I what you just told me, I hear from a lot of people, and frankly, it is a little bit before it's fine, but watch out, because I'll tell you, if you ask Mark Zuckerberg, I don't want to tell him what I'm up to so much, but I'll tell you why people are signing up so fast on this thing, is because there is a world out there that's going to demand free commerce. There's no question. And it's going to be a big one. Hmm. And this is going to bite at the ankles of eBay pretty quick in the next 12 months.
Yeah, which could be a good acquisition for them.
Yep.
All right.
This is the kind of business where you're going to go to bed tonight, you're going to be thinking about it, and you're going to wake up tomorrow and be like, wow, I'm pretty confident, because that's the way I don't sleep at night sometimes, just thinking about the capacity with which this thing can grow quickly. So.
And I guess, so you're trying to experiment, because your LinkedIn rank's not high right now, and maybe it won't become that high because of traffic all on the social networks.
It's a hyper-distributed business, so we exist everywhere. We're not, it's not about Shopit.com. Shopit.com would be the walled garden, right? It's not about that. Shopit exists within, you know, we went to where the traffic was. We're not trying to drive traffic to our site.
I get it. All right. Is there anything we haven't talked about that we should?
I don't think so. I don't think so. I mean, if something else pops up, you can always, you know, just fire me an email or we can jump on the phone again. I'm trying to think if there's anything else that we should chat about. If something burning sort of pops up that I've missed, I'll most definitely.
That'd be cool. Well, Matt, thank you very much for your time.
Great.